Welcome to As My Whimsy Takes Me. I'm Sharon Hsu.
And I'm Karis Ellison. And we are back in Pym's Publicity with Murder Must Advertise. And Professor Sharon is going to tell us about modernism.
I really feel like maybe I've over-advertised this part now, because it was more of a throwaway thing in our notes where I was like, oh, make sure you talk about like this little paragraph. So I don't have like a grand unified theory of modernism and how this book is modernist, but I know I have mentioned in passing like multiple times that I do find this book to be the most modernist of the Sayers, or the Whimsy mysteries.
So for the ignorant like me, what is like in a literary sense the definition of modernism? Like, what does that mean?
Mm-hmm. Well, I would refer people back to, I forget which early episode it is of ours. I think it was when we were talking about Whose Body, maybe. But literary modernism, broadly as a movement, is, you know, what we think of as coming after the Victorian period in English, British literature in particular. And this is like, I'm just kind of talking from my field of study. So I can't talk to you about modernism nearly anywhere else but Britain. But, you know, some of the characteristics that we think of as coming alongside is a lot of narrative experimentation. So moving away from that realist mode in the big, you know, Victorian novel, as we might think of, like a George Eliot, focus on like one village and all the inhabitants, and kind of giving a faithful representation of the world as it is, and also of like the village sort of standing in for larger society, and you know, maybe more of a morality tale. Some people might think of the Victorians that way. Literary modernism is really characterized a lot more by, we're going to play with how we do the narrative. We're going to play with point of view, and there are ties to kind of like late Impressionism, abstract art, really like, oh gosh, I feel like I'm taking my qualifying exam again. And of course, you know, there's people always like to think or talk about like literary movements, or I guess any kind of art movement, as like discrete units, right? Like first there's Romanticism, and then there's this, and then there's Victorian literature, and then there's modernism. And it's never quite like...
You mean that people don't go like, okay, the calendar's turned over, it's time to move to the next.
Exactly. Yeah. Like, it's so funny when I was doing my qualifying exam, because I did it across two periods. I did it like, you know, 19th and early 20th century British lit. And so you have like early Henry James and late Henry James. And, you know, early Henry James is a Victorian writer and late Henry James becomes modernist. And it, like, it's just, you know. So it gives me the heebie-jeebies a little bit to be making such broad, like,
yeah,
generalizations. But I think, you know, if you think about the writers that we really associate with modernism, like Virginia Woolf, T.S. Eliot, Ezra Pound, James Joyce, there really is a lot of kind of attention paid to that formal experimentation. But there's also, you know, sort of deep character work and interiority as well, and an emphasis on sort of like psychological states and different things. So
is it, you mentioned that the interiority, and like something we've talked about in Sayers, is how we can be deep in a character's point of view. Is that kind of a trait associated with modernism, as opposed to like kind of like the floating, the like omniscient
narrator? I think, no, you're right to say that. I mean, again, I'm like, well, yes and no. Because again, like, I think when I think deep character work, I think a lot about George Eliot. I also think about Jane Austen. You know, I think there's a lot of attention paid. But I think where that differentiation that you're making that's really accurate is, I think the modernists paid a lot more attention to point of view in the sense that people could be wrong about themselves. That point of view could be unreliable, right? That a narrator could be unreliable. So thinking one of the more famous works of this period, kind of early on in what we deem the modernist period, is Ford Madox Ford's The Good Soldier. Mm. And it's all about, I mean, the title itself is sort of tongue-in-cheek because he's a very bad man. And like everybody in this book is just like kind of terrible. But it takes a while for you to really notice that because the narrative point of view is so cathected through like the characters, right? There isn't that judgmental eyeball floating and being like, by the way, these are bad people. You just kind of have to, it's a novel about all these people who think they're really good people, mm-hmm. but actually they're not great. And it's, and so the pointing out of their not greatness, so to speak, is a lot more subtle, right? Than sort of that Eliotic or that Austenian narrative that's like, you know, Emma Woodhouse was this, this, and this. And you're like, oh, yeah, she is this and this. Not like this is how she thinks of herself. This is just, this is both how she thinks of herself, but she is accurate in thinking of herself in that way. And also God has deemed that she is this way, right? So, yeah, so I think there's just a lot that's, I guess that's what I mean when I say that the concern with sort of psychology, right, and the ways that people can... how point of view is unreliable and how narration and self-narration and the ways that we even narrate ourselves to each other or to ourselves can be unreliable because how can you really know yourself, you know, if there is no God to know you?
So it's like being embedded in a point of view, but less that you're observing a character and more that you're embodying the character in some ways in the text.
Yeah, yeah. I think that the narration can be a lot closer to, you know, you're sort of, instead of seeing the character from the outside, sort of seeing through their eyes, right? And we've talked before about that, you know, the Uncle Charles principle of the narrative voice also taking on whatever the voice of that character would be. So like the door waltzed open being, you know, sort of from Peter's point of view, also something that Peter would think, kind of bleeding into the text. And I think another, this will become relevant very, very soon, but I always point to Ulysses by James Joyce as just sort of like a master text in this way, where very soon into the book, like every chapter is kind of told in a different style. So there's the drama episode, there's the one that's like, you know, when you're in Stephen Dedalus's point of view, because he's been reading all this theology, it's like very in this more didactic, like theological bent. Mm-hmm. Or there's like the very final chapter that's told from Molly Bloom's point of view is like six long, long run on sentences because she's just very like, that's how her mind works. Oh, and then this, and then this, and then this, and then this. And it kind of runs on and it's, there's an episode that's told as kind of the opposite of that sort of scientific method, like hypothesis, like sort of as a logical theorem. And the one that I think is interesting to put next to Murder Must Advertise is there is a chapter named Aeolus. So after the god of wind, as we know from the Odyssey, which is sort of the other key text that Ulysses is always recurring to. But that episode is set in a newspaper office. And there are these big, bold headlines just scattered the suit. So there's action, but then it's, you know, it just keeps interrupting itself and giving you these headlines. Mm-hmm. So the whole chapter is, you know, it's sort of a send up on like sort of the windiness of the media. But I think also we were talking last time about the cinematic nature of how Murder Must Advertise opens. And there's sort of that same feeling of like just the, all the headlines whirling around, you know, and all the words and the wordplay. And then, of course, like all of the headlines kind of match what's happening in the action of that scene, which is just Bloom stopping in a newspaper office and like talking to some people. So, yeah, that like there's this one part in Murder Must Advertise, which I dog-eared my page. I know. I'm a carnal lover of books. I can't be bothered. So in chapter five, The Surprising Metamorphosis of Mr. Breeden. So a lot happens in this chapter, right? We check in with Mary and Parker, and Peter's sort of recounting all this stuff. But the very end of the chapter ends from the point of view of a couple of different characters we've met so far. Mm-hmm. So Pamela Dean, who's washing out her silk stockings and thinking about how attractive Mr. Breeden is and how terribly competent and how she likes people to be competent. And then it floats over to Alec Willis, who is one of the copywriters and who we find out, you know, was really carrying a torch for Miss Dean. And that was why he had a falling out with her brother. And, you know, it's like, oh, gosh, what a head I had this morning. Damn sleek brute, like, kind of from his point of view and how much he dislikes Mr. Breeden. And then Diane de Mormory, who let's talk about in a bit, but she's sort of the bright young thing in the dope crowd that Peter's infiltrating. And then at the very end, so we've had these three really, like, you know, we're sort of floating from point of view to point of view of these three characters. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden it pulls all the way back and says, all over London, the lights flickered in and out, calling on the public to save its body and purse. Sopo saves scrubbing. New tracks for nerves. Crunchlets are crisper. Eat Piper Parrish. Drink Pompain. One whoosh and it's clean. So it's like all of these different advertising headlines. The presses, thundering and growling, ground out the same appeals by the millions. Ask your grocer. Ask your doctor. Ask the man who's tried it. Mothers, give it to your children. Housewives, save money. Husbands, ensure your lives. Women, do you realize? Don't say soap. Say Sopo. Whatever you're doing, stop it and do something else. Whatever you're buying, pause and buy something different. Be hectored into health and prosperity. Never let up. Never go to sleep. Never be satisfied. If once you are satisfied, all our wheels will run down. Keep going, and if you can't, try new tracks for nerves. And then it just says, Lord Peter Wimsey went home and slept. And that part just, like, I was trying to find out if Sayers had ever written anything about reading Ulysses, but I could not. But I read that and I'm like, there's no way she wasn't at least aware of, like, what happens in the Aeolus chapter, because it's just kind of that same thing, a whirl of headlines.
Yeah.
And you know, we talked last time too about the sort of pointed disparagement of how advertising serves late capitalism here, mm-hmm. right? And the effect that it's trying to have on people. But yeah, that's when I was like, let's talk about the modernism in this book. That was really the paragraph that I meant, where I'm like, all of a sudden it does this. And it's so, this is just so different from anything we've really had in the Peter book so far. Mm-hmm. Even the ones that are like a little bit more experimental.
Yeah. Well, and like, it reminds me of, in Clouds of Witness, where, like, at the very end, you know, there's the woman who's lived in the country all her life, who's in London for the first time, and she's, like, amazed by all the advertisements, and they're described very differently, you know, and part of it is because that is from the perspective of a character, but then also part of it, I think, is that this book is written differently and at a different point in her progression as a writer. But I didn't have a developed thought there.
No, but I like that contrast of, like, she can kind of show the same thing but in such a different way, right? And I think to my dissertation that I was writing at the time, the Sayers chapter was about Gaudy Knight, but I think there are some things about class in this book, and in particular that, you know, those threads were getting picked up in Gaudy Knight as well. And I was really interested in how the literary modernists, you know, they were also really self-conscious about their project. You have, like, Ezra mm-hmm. Pound and T.S. Eliot just constantly making these declarations of, like, we're doing something no one's ever done before. And, you know, we're making things, like, there's sort of this self-conscious difficulty or self-prescribed difficulty. Like, Joyce is also famous for saying, oh, I've put so many puzzles into Ulysses that it'll keep the professors busy for centuries. And on the one hand, he was right. And on the other hand, like, what a dickish thing to say, right? Because it makes people think, like, it makes people think that they can't read the book. And yeah. I personally am like, it's not true. Like, it's, but I think there was a class aspect to that too, where you have these, you know, these authors who are like, oh, we're going to just put in all these, like, bits of untranslated Greek and Latin, and we're not for the mass culture. We're for, like, a certain educated group. Even though classical learning was actually, like, a lot more widespread. So, mm-hmm. so the anxiety, I think, is a little bit like, oh, it used to be that knowing Latin and Greek would set us apart, but now, you know, now they're letting women learn it, and they're letting, like, middle-class people learn it, and what do? You know, we just, like, make our work, quote-unquote, more and more difficult. So, yes, modernism in a nutshell. It is fun to see Sayers experiment, though.
That's really interesting, though, to think about how Sayers is, like, borrowing modernist methods and also still doing the untranslated Latin and Greek. Where does this is just for my own curiosity. Where does, like, timeline-wise, where does she fall in comparison to kind of, like, the big name, like, in compared to Joyce and...
Yeah. So she... I mean, Murder Must Advertise is late. Mm-hmm. It's, what, 33, right? We tend to think of modernism as, like, you know, vaguely 1905, really taking off World War One, post-World War One. So mm-hmm. I remember I mentioned in one of our really early episodes, like one of the influential works on the development of modernism is Paul Fussell's The Great War in Modern Memory. And his basic thesis was like, you know, after a war like World War One, there's just this rupture of people's beliefs in like a good and progressing society, because like the Victorians were really into kind of a teleological, like everything's getting better all the time, especially with all this technology we've got, ignore the children in the coal mines. And after a war like World War One, particularly all of the language of like chivalry and honor, and you know, he's really contrasting the poetry that comes out of World War One and something like a Tennyson, right? Like the Charge of the Light Brigade versus like, oh, all these young men who are writing about trench warfare. So really, that's kind of the period we think of as high modernism. Ulysses is, it's like published in installments starting in, I believe, 1918, and then collected in 1922 or 23 as like a book. So that's right in line with when Whose Body is published as well. Mm-hmm. So there's kind of no way that Sayers wasn't like aware, right? And
yeah,
and in, was it Strong Poison, one of the literary parties that Peter goes to, everyone's talking about D.H. Lawrence, and you know, like she kind of name checks those guys.
Yeah, so there's been, you know, like a good decade for that to really kind of permeate social awareness.
Yeah and really, I mean, you know, Virginia Woolf ran a press with her husband, Leonard, right? And Ezra Pound had certainly set himself up as the arbiter of taste, which the less said about that, the better. But, you know, these were writers who were really just kind of also in like the larger cultural milieu, so to speak.
Yeah.
I also, I think to get back closer to the book, we really wanted to talk about the secondary characters, and I'll have a fun little game for us shortly, but I was thinking a lot about, this is, so when I was in grad school, there's sort of these like apocryphal tales that get passed along about like the most terrible question someone gets asked in their oral exams. And I think one person in my department was asked like, Pride and Prejudice, Five Sisters, why five? Go. I see your face. Yeah, I know. And then someone else was asked, like, well, how do you know who the main character in a book is? And I think both people recurred to this influential text, influential in, like, English literature terms, you know, academic terms, but by a scholar named Alex Wallach called The One Versus the Many. And the subhead is minor characters in the space of the protagonist in the novel. And we don't have to get into it, and I'm, like, not really well-versed enough in that book to explain much of the thesis, but he talks a lot about this idea of character space and how, I think especially the Victorian novel, but he takes Jane Austen as one of his examples, you start having this proliferation of minor characters who are drawn really, really vividly, right? And like really true to life. And everyone is kind of jostling for primacy. Everyone's kind of jostling for space in the plot, and that a lot of what we think of as plot and narrative actually comes from that, not antagonism, but that the ability for the novel to present so many characters and to bring them forward and to push them back and so forth. And so there's kind of this idea that like, well, but anyone could actually be the protagonist. You know, the protagonist isn't necessarily the person who has the most lines in a novel. They're not necessarily the perspective through which the novel is told, if the novel is, you know, presenting multiple perspectives. Or like in the case of Murder Must Advertise, is Peter the protagonist? I mean, yes, because he's the detective, but also, is he? He's in disguise. Like, we don't get a lot from his perspective until a little bit further in. So I find all those questions really interesting. And I think the idea of, like, a network of characters all vying for space. I find that a useful way of approaching a book like this, where I'm like, and who and huh? And like, I just like kept writing, scribbling down in the back of my book, like, okay, you know, here are all the copywriters, and here are all the people in the who are the account managers, and da 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 da, because there are just so many of them. But I thought we could run down at least the copy department.
Yeah.
And my proposal is that we talk about them in order of people you would most want to have as a coworker to people you would least want to work with. So yeah, let's play a little game. We have the copywriters themselves are Mr. Ingleby, Mr. Copley, Mr. Willis, Mr. Garrett, and Miss Meatyard, and of course Mr. Breeden. But Cars, who would you most want to have as a coworker?
I think I would most want to work with Miss Meatyard, just because she sounds delightful.
Can you tell our listeners a little bit about her? Just jog their memories.
Yeah, so Miss Meatyard, like, she's the one female copywriter in the department. So she's university educated. She went to Somerville, Sayers College in Oxford. And she makes some of the other people in the office just a little uncomfortable, because she's a very modern woman with a lot of independence, and doesn't display a lot of womanly virtues, which I would find very comforting. I feel like there's an element of, I think that I would get along with Miss Meatyard, but also an element of, I would want Miss Meatyard as an ally.
Yes. Right? I feel like both Miss Meatyard and Mr. Ingleby I like a lot, but I'm also like, oh, it would be not good to be on their bad side.
Right.
You definitely want them to like you. Just because they're so clever.
Yeah. Well, like, if we're talking about, like, who I would be working with as myself, if I'm entering this very male-dominated space, it would be really nice to have another woman that I felt that I could be friends with, that I could be allies with. And I think that, like, Miss Meatyard is not that type of person who's just like, oh, it's important to me to be the only woman, you know, like, there's, it's not that Margaret Thatcher thing where it's like the only woman in the room situation.
Yeah. And you're going to gatekeep everyone else.
Yeah. There's only one room for one clever woman. No, I think I could get along with Miss Meatyard. And, you know, she's just got common sense, which in some cases seems to be in short supply.
Yeah, it's interesting, because as we go on in the book, she's always depicted as being very sharp and very observant. And as we move forward, we're going to find out that there are a lot of things that she's kind of already figured out. But she has decided, I think, unlike Peter, that it's none of my business. Maybe I don't need to interfere or poke into or let anybody know that I see the goings on. And that's really interesting, I think.
Yeah, it's almost, in some ways, she's like a foil to Peter without the money and influence that he has that gives him the freedom to be an amateur detective, right?
Mm-hmm.
If Peter weren't Lord Peter, if he were just a clever nobody, like, would it be safe for him to run around and do the things that he does?
Probably not very. We see it being very not safe for other people in this book.
Yeah. And I don't know. I'm not saying that I think that this is a, like, strong intentional thread in the book, but I do kind of, like, see that foil of, you know, like, anyone could be clever and figure things out.
Mm-hmm.
But having the wherewithal to do anything about it, it requires privilege to a degree.
Yeah.
And Sayers asks that question of, what degree of responsibility does a person have? And so I think that there's kind of, you know, like, in some ways she's saying, like, privilege and responsibility have to be hand in hand. And, like, she says that outright, right? Like, there's that sense of noblesse oblige that's that's in the book. But I don't know that it's just that. I don't know. I wandered into the weeds a little bit. I got lost.
I
got tangled in my own sentence.
I mean, I do think it's telling that Miss Meatyard is the person who kind of points out to Peter, one of her little, you know, I see more than you think I see statements, is she's like, you know, junior copywriters start at PIMS at $4 a week, which could just about pay for a pair of your shoes. You know, like, kind of letting him know that She's like, you come from money. This is different for you than like someone who actually has to kind of make their honest living, doing the work and doing good work, right? And of course she's talking about copywriting, but like there is, as we've talked about before, like that's just a nice side hobby for Peter while he's doing his detecting. I agree that Miss Meatyard, I think, would be a very good coworker to have if you were on her good side. And I think we would both be. I don't think we're like so clueless that she would throw up her hands at us. I really, this time around, liked Mr. Garrett, who barely factors into the book. But at one point, Peter saying, I wonder why the long-suffering public doesn't rise up and slay us. And it's again kind of a commentary on like, we do a terrible thing by selling people all these things that they don't need. And Mr. Garrett says, they don't know of our existence. They think all advertisements write themselves. When I tell people I'm in advertising, they always ask whether I design posters. They never think about the copy. They think the manufacturer does it himself, says Ingleby. They have to see some of the suggestions the manufacturer does put up when he tries his hand at it. And I was like, oh, this is a complaint that I have made, like, about work, where I'm like, I work on an editorial staff, but we write, basically, we write articles about like what other people are reading and what like reader data is showing us. But people are always like, oh, you're an editor? Does that mean you read books and write reviews all day long? And I'm like, oh, nothing could be further from the truth. Like, nobody knows what I do.
Oh, you think I have time to read books? That's so sweet.
Yeah. Yeah. You think there's a job where I just get to read books? Sweet summer child. So I was just like, oh, Mr. Garrett has the same complaints that I do. That immediately endears him to me.
Well, I also, like, I agree with you that Mr. Garrett seems like a good, solid coworker to have. Because there's another time where Mr. Breeden goes to him for advice, or, like, ostensibly advice to get an idea of why people didn't love Victor Dean. Mm-hmm. And there's the question of, you know, like, stealing ideas. And, like, Garrett's answer is just practical and, like, drama-free to an extent. And I'm just like, there's a reason we don't see Mr. Garrett just a whole lot on the page. It's because he's just chill and minding his own business. And I love that in a man.
I love that in a man. And I love that in a coworker.
Yeah, that's so, like, nice in a coworker.
You got your domain, I got mine. If I say something really smart in a meeting, you back me up. If we give each other ideas, we give credit. Like,
yeah,
it's very important in a workplace to maintain harmony.
And I'm not saying that I am not a super interested in knowing all the drama, but I only want to know drama from a detached position.
Oh, I, like, never want to be involved in workplace drama.
No, I don't want to. I don't want to be involved. I just want to know all about it.
So Mr. Garrett becomes very important. I mean, the importance of gossip in this book is really could not be overstated, right? No. And I think we're not talking about the typists, but the typists are very important. And the office errand boys are also very important in finding out all the gossip.
Yeah. It's fun the way the book kind of like shows how there's like the intersections of the different jobs and like the information that people have. And the way information, like, spreads through the office. That's another, you know, like, I can imagine that being filmed in a really fun way. I don't know, like a long panning shot where it goes past the windows and you see people going in and out. And I just feel like a smart director could have a lot of fun portraying that.
If any enterprising movie producer who's listening to our podcast would like to produce a whole series, especially this one, we would not say no. We'd be happy to consult.
So our top two picks are definitely Meatyard and Garrett. And Ingleby's not bad. You know, I feel like he could get a little, he's one of those people where it's just like, you're fine, but also you could be a little annoying.
He could be a bit much, I could see. Yeah.
Yeah. But not too bad. Mm-hmm.
I do like that he and Breeden are always in each other's offices. I mean, other people in the publicity office are like, oh, it's because you're both, you know, public school men, you're both university men.
Yeah, but so is Mr. Garrett, and he's not quite so gossipy. And I wonder, do we have a clear idea of, like, Garrett's age? Is there an age difference between him and Ingleby?
Oh, that's a good question.
I think Ingleby is meant to be a good bit younger than Peter.
Yeah. Tallboy gives Garrett a playful punch at one point, so I would imagine that that maybe makes him a bit younger. You know, as much as we've been saying Garrett doesn't stick his nose in, there is this part where, you know, Tallboy is always kind of dropping off these letters to the typist to put in the outgoing mail for him.
Oh, that's
and,
true.
May I drop this in your out basket, Miss Rossiter? That's Tallboy. And I love this. She said, "Serpently," said the lady with gracious humor, presenting the basket to receive the letter. "All Billydoos receive our prompt attention are immediately forwarded to their destination by the quickest and surest route." "Let's see," said Garrett. "I bet it's to a lady, and him a married man, too." "No, you don't, Tallboy, you old devil. Stand still, will you? Tell us who it is, Miss Rossiter." "K. Smith, Esquire," said Miss Rossiter. "You lose your bet." So I just love that. Again, you know, we talk so much about how Sayers uses dialogue to convey what's happening. You can just see Tallboy's, like, trying to get out of there, and Garrett's, like, grabbing him, like, no, you don't. So just having a little bit of fun. So I retract my statement that Garrett always keeps his nose out of other people's business, but he still seems like a good chap.
Yeah, definitely more fun to work with than Mr. Copley.
Oh, Mr. Copley. I was going back and forth on if Mr. Willis or Mr. Copley would be the worst, and I came down on, I think, Mr. Copley.
Yeah, which I think that Willis is probably a lot more tolerable if he doesn't think that you're scooping his girl.
And if he's not in love with you.
And then that just turns him into just the worst wet blanket.
Yeah. Yeah. So Willis was the backstory there is he was a kind of special friend of Victor Dean's from the office and very much carries a torch for Victor's sister, Pamela, and basically gets in a row with Victor prior to Victor's death because he thinks that he's corrupting his sister by hanging out with all these, you know, drug addicts and so forth. He's like, I don't like it. And there's that really, really funny bit where Pamela Dean comes to the office to meet with Breeden and Will. It's like all told from Willis's point of view, right? Where he's like following them and he thinks he's being so
dramatic.
It's so dramatic. He's like, how dare he? How dare Breeden? And of course, Peter's on to him the whole time, if you're gonna sit with a newspaper in front of your face, make sure that you don't sit in front of a mirror.
Well, I love the line where, you know, he gets in the taxi behind them. He's like, "Follow that taxi," just like someone in a book.
Yeah.
Oh, Willis. I'm sure he's a perfectly fine person in other circumstances, but in this book, he is not
at his best.
Yeah, he's not in a particularly good light.
He's pretty condescending to Pamela, and it is interesting the bit that's from his point of view right before the advertising headlines that I was reading earlier when he's thinking about Breeden. He uses some pretty foul language.
He does
like about Diane de Mormory. So there's just a little bit of misogyny,
just a tad running
through his DNA. Yeah, mm-hmm. Which. So, yeah, I don't, well, I mean,
like, also his attitude towards Pamela is very, like, he has this motivation of wanting to make the world safe for her to live in, and it's
I'm gonna
very
save her.
Ugh.
Your face. let it be known to our listeners that Kara's just made a face.
And like, it cites spoilers for the ending, right, to say that at the end they do get engaged, Pamela Dean and Willis, and of all of the kind of like wrapping things up notes, that's my least favorite. I'm just like
why, Pamela? Why? Yeah, well, because so much of whatever happens between them happens off stage, right?
Yeah.
Like in the first part they both figure pretty prominently, like Peter has Pamela introduce him to the drug gang basically, and Willis is all on his high horse, like, how dare you, and you know, Peter's like, old chap, she brought me along, like, you know, and at the end of like one of these masquerade parties they go to, Peter has Pamela Dean get Willis out of there, and but then they kind of fall out of the story a bit, and then the next thing you know, it's the end and they're engaged, and it's like, what? Huh? Who? What? Yeah.
And you know, like, maybe possibly they work things out between them, and maybe possibly Willis realized that he was being just an absolute heel. long pause.
I might have to, the more we talk about him, I'm like, oh, he's worse than Copley. Because, yeah, working with a ranked misogynist is just...
Not that I don't think that Copley is a misogynist also. I think that Copley falls in that category of older men who don't think that women should work outside the home.
Like, he's one of the ones who really disapproves of Miss Meatyard being there.
Yeah. It reminds me of the assistant in Mr. Urquhart's office from Strong Poison, who's just like, in my day, ladies were, you know, like...
Ladylike.
Yeah. But he definitely makes comments to Miss Murchison about how women used to be, how things used to be in an office before all these women came in.
Okay. The thing I really dislike about Mr. Copley, aside from the, you know, what he would call old-fashioned ideas, is, and I think we've always, like, all of us have had a coworker like this, he loves being a martyr. He's just, like, willing to be a martyr at any point, and then he wants everyone to be like, oh, Mr. Copley, thank you for going so above and beyond on this thing that nobody asked you to do. And then he's, like, on his high horse when that doesn't happen, right? And I mean, I guess to his credit, he really is the coworker that the narrative gives us the most like extended rope to hang himself on, because there's that long interlude in chapter 8, the convulsive agitation of an advertising agency, right, where we can sketch this out a little bit more, but he's already written a little slogan in his head. You can count on Copley in a crisis. And I'm like, oh, God, save us from the coworkers who are like, I was just trying to help. Karis, do you want to give the listeners just like a brief summary of what happens in that chapter?
Oh, my goodness. So it's the Great New Tracks row.
In all caps.
And it's a central like kind of turning point of the plot of the book, because it's one of those things where it's like, it makes some of the pieces click together, I think, for Peter. And it's when he kind of like starts assembling things. Like, we as the reader don't necessarily know that, but things kind of like start coalescing at that point.
Yeah. And I think we could mention that at this point in the book, Peter's already, he has a pretty good idea what happened to Dean, right? He's found like a little scarab beetle that Dean always kept in his pocket at the foot of the stairs. He's gone up onto the roof. He learns that one of the office boys had a little homemade catapult confiscated. So he never outright says, but the enterprising reader can kind of put together that he thinks someone went up on the roof and basically used the catapult to hit Victor Dean in the back of the neck and kill him.
Yeah, that there was a deliberate murder and it was not an accidental death. And so Peter is just like, there's been a murder, and he's looking for the motive to help him narrow down who it could be. And he's also been making efforts to figure out where everyone was at the time, which is a tremendous, tremendous effort, because it's such a rabbit warren and people are always running around and no one's ever where they're supposed to be. But the Great New Tracks row is, for me, it's fascinating because it's just like, oh man, what a complex system for getting ads into the newspaper. So New Tracks for Nerves, it's one of the big accounts of Pym's publicity, and it's, the account is handled by Mr. Tallboy. It's his department. And every week they have a big advertisement that goes in the main newspaper. And it's this whole, like, we get this picture painted for us of what a trial it is to get the ads passed, to get them made, to get them approved, to get them sent over. It is an ordeal. And on the day in question, it's like the evening before, you know, the ad's supposed to come out in the paper, and Mr. Copley is the only copywriter left in the office. So the head charwoman, Mrs. Crump, like, comes to fetch him because a phone is ringing, and she answered it, and it's the newspaper, and they're just like, we can't run this ad because it is dubious. It could be read as obscene.
You always have to do the check. So every now and then at work, we will have a big initiative, like summer reading or something. And, you know, you always, it's a big meeting of the minds of like editorial and design and marketing, and everybody reviews all of the designs and the assets. And I learned really early, you always have to do a pass where it's like, does anything look like a body part? Does anything look like it could be misconstrued? Because if it can be, it will be, right? Somebody did not do the obscenity glance over at this week's new Tracks for Nerves ad.
Yeah, well, and like Sayers, even, it's not at this point, but when she's talking about like what Peter has learned about advertising in his first week, it's that if something could be read as obscene, the great British public would read it that way, which I think is fair, because just the other day I saw a lamp on Facebook Marketplace and I was just like, should I get this fruit lamp with a penis on it? It was a pear.
Did you?
No, I didn't have a use for it. But I'm just like, did this pear have to look quite so phallic?
It's because they didn't have a Mr. Copley at the factory to save the day.
The ad in question, apparently the headline is fine and the illustration is fine, but put together, very suggestive. So the newspaper calls up and says, hey, we can't run this. Can you do anything about it? And Mr. Copley, you know, calls around trying to get in touch with people and he can't get a hold of anyone. And so at the very last minute, he rewrites the headline because the sketch can't be changed. But the newspaper is just like, oh, you know, like we can cut away the headline and put in something else. And so he has to come up with a headline that fits the copy and the sketch. And he does it. He saves the day. But then he also, you know, he had to go into Mr. Tallboy's office to find a proof of the ad that was sent over so that he knows what he's working with. And when he's closing the desk, an envelope falls out that got caught, you know, like in the lid of the desk. And it is full of money. It's full of £50, which...
So much money.
Which is so much money.
It's, I mean, I did the math. It was that £50 would have been 1/6 of Victor Dean's annual salary, because they mention at one point how much he was making a year. So that is a substantial amount of money.
And so Mr. Copley makes a choice. He really wants to show up the younger people in the department, and he wants to teach Tallboy a lesson because he really resents the fact that Tallboy bunked off home before all this happened.
Like in my day, I never would have, you know, we would make sure that everything was safely to the newspaper and blah, 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 blah. Yeah. And he has this thought in like, again, this is so many caps, right? Mr. Tallboy condemned as thoughtless, capital T, and unfair, capital U. Long advertising practice had given him a trick of thinking in capital letters. It was putting temptation in people's way. Here was the colossal sum of £50 so carelessly secured that the mere opening of the desk sent it skittering to the floor for Mrs. Crump and her corps of charladies to find. No doubt they were all very honest women, but in these hard times, a working woman could hardly be blamed if she... Like, it's so funny because it's like the clash of his, like the misogyny and the classism of like, he is just putting temptation in the way of these innocent charwomen, like...
How could they be expected to resist such temptation if you...
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, he carries it off and locks it up in a drawer in his own desk. And when then leaving the building, he does see Tallboy across the street and realize that Tallboy is probably going back to get the envelope and decides not to cross back over and tell him what happened. And instead go home, have a fight with his wife... because he didn't call her to tell her that he was stuck late at work. And in the morning, Tallboy is not pleased.
Furious. And Mr. Copley, who'd had all these visions, been crowned in laurels for saving the day, suddenly finds that nobody really is much on his side about all this.
And oh, poor Mr. Copley. He has a terrible morning. Like, he has a bad night. A terrible indigestion. He doesn't get very much sleep, but then he oversleeps. He argues with his wife again. His train is delayed. He cut his face shaving, and so he's got cotton stuck on his face. And he gets to work very, very late and immediately has everyone talking to him, being like, hey, they're looking for you. Hey, they're looking for you. Did you know that they're looking for you?
And, I mean, it's funny because earlier in the chapter, you know, it really, the narrative is at pains to be like, he tried to call this person, he tried to ring up this person, and then, you know, finally it was like, well, I will save the day. And it's not until, yeah, the morning after where he's saying, well, you know, I tried to ring up so-and-so, and I, you know, you weren't there, and you weren't there, and I hope you're satisfied with this work. And Mr. Armstrong, who is one of the two copy chiefs, says, yes, yes, I see, but why didn't you ring up Mr. Hankin, who's the other copy chief? I'm always home at 6, added Mr. Hankin. It's very seldom that I go out. When I do, I always leave directions where I am to be found. Dismay seized upon Mr. Copley. He had clean forgotten Mr. Hankin, And he knew well enough that Mr. Hinken, mild as were his manners, was quick to resent anything in the nature of a slight. Like, I do always feel kind of like cold water go down my spine at this point. Of like, this is why you should just never try to be a martyr at work, because it will backfire. It will backfire in the most spectacular way of like you forgetting about the person who will most resent all of this. It's just one of those things where I'm like, oh, you could so clearly tell that Sayers worked in an office. Like all of this office politicking and the drama and the some people trying to, you know, get ahead in certain ways. It just, it's so real. But if only real life office politics was this fun. All right. Well, that is the rundown of the copy department at PIMS and who we would and wouldn't like to work with. But we also check in on two people who I think would always be a delight to work with, Karis, in these early chapters. We get to pay a visit to Chief Inspector Parker and Lady Mary, because Peter has decided to have all his mail sent to a little mailbox at their place to keep up the ruse. And, you know, we need a nice, like, summary chapter where he's just explaining things to people so that we can be like, oh, okay,
which is helpful.
This is the mystery so far.
So much going on.
So helpful. Yes, always. Anytime there's, like, a list or an inquest or something, I'm like, oh, good, my nerves are soothed.
Thank you for providing all the facts, man.
Yes. But yeah, it's been a hot minute since we've seen Lady Mary in particular. What do you make of her now?
I love it. We talked a good bit about Lady Mary in Clouds of Witness, obviously. We get to see her briefly in Strong Poison and see that she's, you know, like matured a little bit. And we find out that she and Parker have continued to have a friendship. And obviously they get engaged at that point. But I was thinking, Sayers kind of describes this wonderful setup that they've got for their household where the balance that they find, which considering like how much of a theme like equality is and how to have equality in a marriage, how much of a recurring, not even just like a theme, but thought experiment that is in Sayers. Mm-hmm. It's so fun to have this tidy little presentation of a lovely balanced, because obviously Lady Mary is much wealthier than her husband. That was like a barrier to their relationship, not so much on her end, but on his end, because he felt that class difference very deeply. And so what they've done is Lady Mary has put all of her money in trust with her brothers, and they give her an allowance that's exactly equal to her husband's salary. So they get the double income, which obviously is very nice, but it's exactly equal. And Sayers kind of like describes how much Mary enjoys running her little household and like doing the little economies. And I love that for her, because how nice is that to not have to worry about money and get to live like the London equivalent of a cottagecore? You know, like, it's like, is there a name for like the urban version of cottagecore where it's the romanticizing of the domestic without the financial fears that come with, usually?
I think we just call that trust fund, baby.
Oh, is that what it is?
No, but I get what you're saying. Like, I mean, I don't mean that in a disparaging way to Lady Mary. I think it is like really a genius arrangement that they've come to, because it means nobody resents anybody, right? But that she gets to, you know, manage the household and have in some ways some restrictions. I think that's the part she enjoys the most, is getting to kind of, it says, you know, she now patronized her wealthy brother with all the superiority which a worker feels over the man who merely possesses money, right? She kind of gets to live out her like little Bolshevist dreams, but without actually, I don't know. It's not quite champagne socialism, but I get what you're saying. Someone should come up with the term.
You can just see how much healthier that is for her. Because she is someone who needs something to do, but her life wasn't, nothing like contributed to her having a career, which obviously she, in Strong Poison, there are mentions of her designing things and doing house decorating, but, you know, it didn't feel like it was something that she was super into. And for some people, running a household is very fulfilling, and she's one of those people, and I love that for her.
Yeah.
Like, in a very, you found what you enjoy and you get to do it.
And they're so harmonious. The narrative even says when it's introducing the scene, right? They're in Chief Inspector's Bloomsbury flat. Lady Mary is industriously knitting an infant's vest. Parker smoking a pipe. On the hearth rug was a large tabby cat. The scene was almost ostentatiously peaceful and domestic. But you really get the sense, like, they have a really solid, loving marriage. And that Peter... It's kind of a nice family circle for Peter to be in. You know, you don't get the sense that Gerald and Helen have ever been like a nice safe haven.
Imagine them having a tabby cat. No. Like, they would never. No. Like a Persian something or other. But a tabby cat, never. Far too common. I love how sweet and charming it is. I love that Peter goes there to hang out.
Also that Parker and Mary both just constantly take the air out of him. Like, Parker says, "Your narrative style, though racy, is a little elliptical. Could you not begin at the beginning and go on until you come to the end? And then, if you are able to, stop."
Oh, I love it. I also, like, it's hard to believe considering how many times I've read that, but it was just this time that I realized that it's hinting that they're expecting a third child.
Oh, yeah.
That had never occurred to me before, but but they've got small Peter, and then they have got
Mary Lou Costa.
Yeah, Mary Lou Costa. Mm-hmm. So they've got their little daughter, and I think the knitting of a baby sweater is a hint that there is a third little Parker in the works. Although that's not mentioned, I don't think, in any of the later books. But let's assume. Let's assume. But it's a nice break also from the office environment.
Yes.
But it is, I think it's very deliberate also that we don't see Peter in his own home until the end of the book. I think there's a very deliberate way that Bunter doesn't appear and Piccadilly doesn't appear. Those familiar settings, like even just thinking back to the first book and those like repeated descriptions of his library, you know, sitting room. We don't see any of it because he's living this separate life, even though theoretically we know that he's going back there to sleep most nights, presumably, when he's not busy being a harlequin. You know, like he's still living there.
Mm-hmm. He's not going full method. Yeah.
Yeah. But we as readers are not seeing him in that environment, and we aren't even being reminded of that environment very much. And I think that's a very deliberate choice that Sayers made to keep us out of that part of his life and to keep like us as readers focused on the office setting and on existing in a different class sphere. And the closest we come is when Diane de Montmorency's crowd crashes a party at the Duke of Denver, his older brother.
Their townhouse.
Their townhouse. But again, like, it's still not Peter's space. Like, that to me is very interesting that we never see him in his own natural environment.
Was there anything else we wanted to mention about the Parkers? It is really nice to, I think, kind of see a culmination of their story, and also after seeing so many unhappy marriages because something in the marriage was unequal between the two partners. It's like, here's a little hint of domestic bliss. And, you know, you've got to think that Peter's somehow squirreling it away in his mind, even though the only reference we get to one Harriet Vane in this book is a very, very glancing, like, blink and you'll miss it. Doesn't even have her by name. Which is, I think, also maybe goes into what you were saying about we see Peter almost entirely outside of his actual life, right? Our friend Angela, whom some people might remember from our Five Red Herrings episode, she texted us like that Murder Must Advertise might have been the first Lord Peter book she ever read, and she was like, "I kept waiting for him to show up. Like, where is he? Who is this Breeden person?" I think it adds to, there's kind of a nightmarish quality to some of the Harlequin stuff, right? It's always the middle of the night. He's, you know, infiltrating this dope gang. It's very at odds with kind of the office. The office bits feel very, you know, sort of satirical and fun. And then the deeper and deeper he gets in with the world of Diane de Montmorency and her crowd, there's, she starts off by just being like enthralled by him. Actually, my favorite line in the entire book is this part where Peter's describing Diane to the Parkers, and he says, "She thinks I'm the world's eighth wonder. Absolutely the lobster's dress shirt." Which is just the best. I'm like, why don't we say that all the time? But as there's this moment that comes where Diane suddenly switches over to seeing him as like a figure of death and an uncanny mm-hmm. figure, and she becomes afraid of him.
Yeah. Should we like just really quickly outline how like the connection that Diane de Montmorie had a fling with Victor Dean, and Victor Dean yes. got pulled into her kind of circle of bright young things who like party quite hard,
very hard,
drug users, and that is what Willis objected to because he introduced his sister to Diane de Montmorie, which is, you know, like that was the breaking point between Willis and Victor Dean mm-hmm. and also Willis and Pamela Dean, because she objected to him interfering. And so the whole situation with Peter getting into the masquerade party through Pamela was a ploy to meet Diane de Montmorie. And Peter does some acrobatics to get Diane's attention. Like, he climbs to the top of this big fountain and then jumps into the shallow pool at the bottom.
He dives. Yeah. And he's in a Harlequin costume. Yeah.
So dangerous.
So dangerous. He says it pays to advertise. I got her attention.
Yeah. And then, like, he also interrupts a car race that Diane is having with a couple of other bright young things, and mm-hmm.
and he plays what's the song he plays on,
yeah, Tom the Piper's Son.
Yeah, yeah. So every time he appears after that near her, he plays this little tune. So he's definitely sort of hyping up the mysteriousness of himself, right? And
yeah,
and playing into this whole like, I'm maybe a little otherworldly.
I do kind of want to point out, like, this is the most, despite the fact that we are like being deliberately separated from Peter's upper class life, this is the most Bruce Wayne that we see him. And I'm like, he is in his 40s now,
mm-hmm.
and he is climbing things and jumping off of stuff and wandering around all night in the woods dressed as Harlequin. And then getting up and going to work in the morning and doing like brilliant copy. And I think that there's a very funny comparison. He befriends Ginger Joe, who's one of the errand boys, who plays a very important role because he was the one that had the catapult. He becomes Peter's kind of like irregular a little bit and does some detecting for him. And Ginger Joe is a big fan of Sexton Blake, who is this like action hero, pulp fiction hero. And there's a funny bit where we probably don't have time to talk about the full incident of Parker getting coshed, but
we'll pick up there next time, maybe.
Yeah, but there's the fact that like Parker has been injured and Peter is giving him a hard time because just like, you're complaining about a cracked collarbone, but in this book about Sexton Blake that my friend Ginger Joe has lent me, like Sexton Blake does all these things and he's tied up and for hours and blah, 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 and thrown down a staircase and then on the strength of a couple of sandwiches and hot coffee, he runs off for to have an airplane chase and all this stuff. And I'm just like, Peter, you in your 40s are jumping off of things and climbing trees and staying out all night.
Shinning up pipes.
And yeah. Shinning up pipes. Sexton Blake, what? What in the Sexton Blake is that, Peter? But yeah, so like just in terms of showing remarkable, slightly unrealistic powers, I do think that Sayers gave Peter a little bit of a boost, and I think that it's very humorous.
He gets a little bit of a level up. I always find myself, I think I'm just so taken with the advertising and the office politics bits that I always forget until I'm rereading, like, just how outlandish some of the drug gang bits are. And
yeah.
This time I was, like, I was noticing the back copy of my book is, you know, says a bit of cocaine, a hint of blackmail, and some wanton women can be read between the lines. And then there is the brutal succession of murders, 5 of them, each one a fixed fee for advertising a deadly secret. And I was like, are there 5 murders? Like, I always forget kind of, again, the orgy of murders towards the end of the book.
Yeah, there are quite a few. But also, like, they happen so quickly and they don't. Most of them don't happen to people that we know. They're just...
No, yes. To kind of give you a little hint of how dangerous it actually is.
Yeah.
Well, I just think this book is the lobster's dress shirt.
It is the lobster's dress shirt.
So these fine folks have joined us at the $5 or above Harriet Vane tier since our last recording, and as of this recording, which is taking place on February 11th. Thank you, Sarah V., Catherine, and Elaine E. We really appreciate the support.
Yes, we appreciate it so much. And to all of our continuing patrons, we're so grateful to all of you for making it possible for us to continue this project.
Yeah, and we've been really enjoying your comments in our little open episode chats and the polls and things like that.
Yeah, and we are getting ready to launch our a book recommendation from Sharon, which I'm looking forward to hearing what you've been reading. Yeah, it'll be the first of many. If our patrons who have already heard it enjoyed it, we're glad. And if you are interested in it and haven't joined our Patreon yet, you can find it on patreon.com/asmywhimsytakesme. And we have other social media also.
Yes, we can also be found on Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as @whimsypod. Our website for more episodes, show notes, transcripts, etc. is asmywhimsytakesme.com, whimsy spelled W-I-M-S-E-Y, just like his lordship.
And if you would like to email us, you can email us at talkingpiffle@gmail.com.
We read all the messages and are very grateful for them.
Respond to them eventually, maybe, probably.
maybe, probably, yes. Our logo is by Gabby Vicioso, and our theme music was composed and recorded by Sarah Mihalik. And if you are enjoying the podcast, we'd love to get a 5-star rating and review from you on Apple Podcasts or anywhere else fine podcast reviews can be found.
So join us next time for more Talking Piffle. Think our listeners would mind if I call them a dickwad. A douche canoe.